sizzling conditions.
Temperatures will be reaching the 95 to 100 degree range over the next few days with very high heat indices of 110 to 115.
Orevec says the northern plains will start to see some relief as a cold front is now pushing into the area. Mexican authorities are preparing nearly 900 shelters in food-prone areas along the country's southwestern coast as Hurricane Dora grows in strength in the Pacific. Forecasters say the storm is centered about 240 miles south of Acapulco and is moving in a northwesterly direction. And the UN says that famine is now gripping parts of southern Somalia, where tens of thousands of individuals have died from malnutrition. The country is experiencing its worst drought in 50 years. I'm Jim Howard, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com. With tools to monitor and protect the online reputations of doctors, lawyers, and business professionals, learn more at Reputation.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry to say that we were not able to make contact with our scheduled first hour guest, Christian Parenti. We were going to talk about his book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. We'll see if we can reschedule that for another day. Instead, we will go to the Focus archive for a program from one of our recent shows. So that means that in the first hour here, we'll not take calls. But again, do keep in mind that we will be live hour number two. Celeste Quinn will be hosting that hour, and she'll be talking with historian Gary Scott Smith about his book, Heaven in the American Imagination. But again, this first hour focus is from our archives. We'll not be taking calls. In 2001, five people died after being exposed to anthrax contained in letters sent through the U.S. mail. A number of other people were infected, and thousands who were at risk of infection were treated with antibiotics. After a long investigation and after initially naming one man as their chief suspect, the FBI identified a scientist, a man named Bruce Ivins, a scientist who had spent a lot of his career working on a vaccine against anthrax. They named him as the culprit. This is a man who actually at one point had been an advisor to the FBI in their investigation. 1 week after being named the chief suspect, Bruce Ivins committed suicide. In this hour, we'll be talking with journalist David Willman about the 2001 anthrax attacks, the subject of his new book, which is titled The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. The book is published by DeBantam, and it's just recently out. David Willman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who has written for the Los Angeles Times. In this book, he makes the argument that very little was learned from this episode. In fact, he says he thinks the nation may be more at risk than it was before. And Mr. Willman, hello.
Good morning, David.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
It is a remarkable story with some interesting, fascinating characters, raises an awful lot of questions about law enforcement and how you go about pursuing someone like this. So we'll do our best to sketch it out, and if people want to read it in greater detail, they can look at Mirage Man. But it truly is a remarkable story. What, in fact, got you so interested in writing about this and ultimately investing a couple of years in the story?
Well, David, I decided to actually leave my position with the Los Angeles Times to pursue this book because I became convinced, based on my work for the newspaper, that there are incredibly valuable and essential lessons that have to be learned and applied from the 2001 anthrax letter attacks, which I found really are the most consequential crimes, if you will, of our lifetime. And what I found in my initial reporting and what drove me to do the book all the way through was a realization that even the most fundamental facts and circumstances surrounding the anthrax letter attacks were greatly confused, badly mauled, in some cases perhaps even vandalized. And so it's really hard to get essential lessons that can be applied when there's no clarity as to what the fundamental facts are. So That's the contribution that I thought I could make in pursuing a book, and I think this book delivers that.
The first person to die as a result of the exposure to the anthrax was a man named Robert Stevens, who worked as a photo editor at the National Enquirer in Florida. And initially, there was no suspicion this was an act of terrorism. I'm sure, in fact, probably initially, it was something to public health authorities in the area. There, it was something of a mystery how it is this man had managed to become infected.
Exactly. This is something that really vexed the public health authorities. Robert Stevens, as you say, was a photo editor at the Parent Offices of the National Enquirer in Lantana, Florida. And on October 4th, 2001, then Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson held a press conference, actually at the direction of President Bush, in which he announced that this fellow, Mr. Stevens, was hospitalized with inhalational anthrax. And, the Centers for Disease Control was trying to get on top of it. You know, who was thinking to look for anthrax? I mean, sort of the watchwords, if you will, of the public health community, for good reason, is when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Mm-hmm. Robert Stevens died the next day. And one of the things I bring out in the book, I think it's a really powerful and dramatic moment, is actually, David, within 24 hours of the cerebral spinal fluid from Robert Stevens being extracted and delivered to a geneticist named Paul Keim at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona, there was a determination that the type of anthrax, the strain of anthrax that had killed Robert Stevens, was called the Ames strain. And that was of high significance to people like Paul Keim, who appreciated that the Ames strain does not exist out in the wild that we know of. I mean, it's been observed in the wild only once, really. What it is used for is the hottest strain, the most popular strain, for biodefense research, originally at Fort Detrick, Maryland, in the United States military's program, and then at other particular laboratories around the country and several around the world. So in the estimation of someone like Paul Keim and some other key people who he was talking to at that time, they pretty much had a very strong reason to suspect at that moment, within 24 hours of Robert Stevens' diagnosis of having inhalational anthrax, that this was a bioterrorism event.
Yeah, a very important clue there right at the start. Well, at what point, though, did it become really obvious that this was something much larger than the death of Mr. Stevens, and that what, in fact, we had here was a biological attack?
Right. I think the event that put the anthrax letter attacks literally onto the national stage occurred on October 15, 2001, and that's when a letter addressed to then-Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle was opened in the Senate Hard Office Building here in Capitol Hill in Washington. And, I mean, this here we have an anonymous anthrax-laced letter with sort of language that is intended to suggest Islamic extremism. Really, it was worded to suggest a direct tie-in to Al-Qaeda and the September 11th attacks. Here, this weapon, if you will, has landed right inside the heart of the national government. And so at that point in time, this was no longer considered a public health matter. This was a crime, a very serious, grave crime. And it shut down Congress effectively. It disrupted the operations of the Supreme Court, had impact on mail delivery at government and businesses all over this country. Major event.
And certainly what people will, I'm sure that people will remember that, and just how frightening it was, the notion that simply going to the mailbox and pulling out the mail and opening up your letters and handling them could possibly be a life-threatening experience.
Exactly. I mean, what a cruel twist here. You know, our entire lives, the mailbox has really been a benign portal of daily life, and all of a sudden it's an instrument of death.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately five people, I believe, died. There were some postal workers who were infected and died, and being exposed to the mail, that would seem to be a natural thing. There was an elderly woman who lived in Connecticut who died as a result of an infection. And there it just seems that somehow some piece of mail that came to her somehow got in contact with the anthrax, whether it was up against something else, whether it was in the result of handling and so forth. Here again, the sort of the isolation of these cases made it, I'm sure, difficult, because that tracking these things, I'm sure that there was no real recognizable pattern here.
Exactly, and obviously here, with the luxury of hindsight, we can be so much more analytical about it all. But in the moment, I mean, we didn't know what scale this event was going to take. I mean, this looked like the second wave of terrorism. The country had already been rocked to its core by September the 11th. And then here we have, you're referring to a woman named Audley Lundgren who lived up in rural Oxford, Connecticut. There was another woman named Kathy Nguyen who was a hospital worker in Manhattan, lived in the Bronx. Both of them died from inhalational anthrax, but yet there was no male ever recovered from their homes or workplaces that was contaminated. The best that we can diagnose is or reconstruct is that they came in contact with a male that had somehow been contaminated with a few loose spores. And, you know, that raised such an insidious prospect that anybody was at risk. Ultimately, I know that a mail handling facility up in Connecticut that processed the mail that went to Audley Lundgren's neighborhood was found to have spores in it. So that made sense there. It was just a problem of unknown dimensions. Of course, there was another letter, as you'll recall, that was addressed to NBC anchor Tom Brokaw, and yet another one that was addressed to quote-unquote editor of the New York Post. So, I mean, these letters, I think the addressees of them, it was all calculated to create maximum shock and awe impact to create a crisis atmosphere.
Yeah. Just thinking about what happened with Audley Lundgren, you wonder how it is that more people didn't become infected as she did because there were odd spores floating around, and it's not the kind of thing that you can that's easy to contain.
Well, excellent point. Audley Lundgren happened to be 94 years old, and in fact, everyone who died of inhalational anthrax, I believe, was almost 50 or over. You know, we just don't have a lot of data on who is most susceptible to inhalational anthrax infection, and I suppose that's a good thing because it's so extraordinarily rare. But that, you know, that might help explain why an Audley Lundgren dies, whereas a healthy 30-year-old who lives just next door who might have had a few spores on their mail survived. Of course, you know, we have the two postal workers here in Washington, D.C., who died from being in the same atmosphere at the Brentwood Postal Facility where probably some spores from the Daschle letter or another letter that was addressed to Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Pat Leahy were also processed. In fact, a plume of spores were found some 30 feet above the work floor at the Brentwood Postal Facility. That's how high the material was propelled upward. You know, the postal sorting machines are so high speed under such compression that there's a lot of distribution.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is David Willman. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He is author of the recent book, The Mirage Man, Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks, and America's Rush to War. It takes a look at the anthrax attacks of 2001, the efforts of the FBI to find the person responsible. Questions are welcome. The book's, by the way, published by Bantam. It's just out. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And perhaps people will remember that the notes that were enclosed with the anthrax letters contained lines like death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great. So clearly coming after the 9/11 attacks, the person or persons responsible either genuinely had a political agenda or one might think, well, they would want the FBI and law enforcement to think that they had a political agenda. How did the FBI start approaching this question of, you know, was this one person? Could this possibly be a group of people? Could this be someone with this political agenda? Could that be a red herring? There seemed to be all sorts of possibilities that you could pursue.
Well, that's so true. And the FBI was in a position of, first of all, trying to investigate an anthrax-caused murders, which the Bureau had never done before. So very steep learning curve there just to get on top of this organism we call Bacillus anthracis. And then, you know, what is the evidence to start working with? Well, you have these two batches of anonymous letters with similar messages in each one. With, you know, no name claiming credit. But as you were saying, David, I mean, each letter started with the date of 9/11/01, and then there were all these other, these lines that clearly were intended to draw a connection with the 9/11 attacks and Islamic extremism. If I may, I'd like to point out something that really struck me in my research that's directly parallel to what the messages in the letters were. And that is, I mean, first of all, the first batch of anthrax-laced letters was actually postmarked in Trenton, New Jersey on September 18th, 2001. And one of the things that really struck me in reconstructing these events for this book is that on September 21st, 2001, now this would have been a time when no one except the perpetrator would have known of the existence of the anthrax letters, wrote an email to Bruce Ivins, I should say, a microbiologist at Fort Detrick, Maryland, who in death stands accused by the FBI of being the perpetrator. He wrote an email on September 21st, 2001, to a woman who he actually had tormented and harassed and had really terrorized over a period of decades. But her attention, her approval of him, of his scientific chops, was something he craved. And he wrote an email to her on September 21st, 2001, really predicting a major event that was going to put Fort Detrick front and center in a national crisis, that crews there would be on call 24/7. We're ready for a biological terrorism event. She had not heard from him in ages, but he made this overture to her. Then on September 26th of 2001, which is just 8 days after the letters are postmarked, but still well before anyone knows about any anthrax-laced letters, Bruce Ivins wrote an email to another woman whose attentions and approval he absolutely craved, a recently departed laboratory technician from Fort Detrick. And he said to her in the email, quote, "I just heard tonight that the bin Laden terrorists for sure have anthrax." And then goes on in the same email to say, quote, "Osama bin Laden just decreed death to all Jews and all Americans," unquote. Now, when the anthrax letters began being recovered, the first batch of them, this exact language was in the letters, quote, "Death to America, death to Israel." And then the second batch said, "We have this anthrax." Now, when you put it all together, it's very parallel with what Bruce Ivins was putting in these emails, which I believe strongly indicates that these were predictive emails.
Yeah. And just I have a couple of callers here we'll get to, and I hope we can go back and flesh this out a little bit more. But I think one important point here, you make reference to this woman, Nancy Hagwood, who had some bad experiences with Bruce Ivins years before, and that he, out of the blue, after not having been in contact, sends her this email, essentially says something big is going to happen. And not all that long after that, the FBI, in an attempt to generate some leads, sent out letters to people who were members of the American Society for Microbiology, a lot of letters, essentially asking for help, saying, here's the kind of person we're looking for. Does this sound familiar to you? Do you think you might know who this person is? And that she, having received that letter, then thought about her email from Ivins, and she thought to herself, this is the guy. I think this is the guy. She actually contacted the FBI and said to them, I think I know who's responsible. It's this guy, Bruce Ivins. And the FBI just let that tip lay there.
Well, that's what happened. Nancy Hagwood, who first encountered Bruce Ivins when she was a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in the mid-1970s, just very quickly, she came under intense attention from Bruce Ivins. It turns out because she's bright, she's attractive, and the third part of the package for Bruce Ivins is that she was a member of the sorority Kappa Kappa Gamma. Bruce Ivins was absolutely obsessed with that sorority and remained obsessed with that sorority into his 60s, and would commit anonymous acts of tormenting on the institution and on individual members of the sorority, including Nancy Hagwood. Just one quick marker with Nancy Hagwood. She was a doctoral student, as I said. Bruce Ivins, after he left UNC Chapel Hill and moved to Maryland, made a trip down there, broke into a lab facility, where Nancy Hagwood had her lab notebook stored with all of her experimental data, everything upon which her doctoral degree or pursuit of it hinged. He stole it, and then he sent her an anonymous note saying, if you want your lab notebook, look in this post office box, this mailbox in Chapel Hill at this corner. She, of course, already had the authorities investigating. they went to the mailbox and recovered the notebook. Bruce Ivins ultimately admitted that he had done all this to the FBI, you know, decades later, literally. Mm-hmm. So there were other instances over the years where Bruce Ivins was tormenting her. So fast forwarding to January 29th of 2002, several months after the anthrax letter attacks were terrorizing the country, the FBI, the leader of the case at that time, sent a letter with the cooperation of the American Society for Microbiology to all 30-some thousand members of ASM in the United States, saying, this is a little bit of the profile of who we think the perpetrator is. One of you out there, or more of you, know who knows this person. If any of this matches up, please let us know. There was one person who responded to that mass email letter to all of the Microbiology Society members. That was Nancy Hagwood, Dr. Nancy Hagwood, then in Seattle, Washington, a microbiologist in her own right. And she said, as you said, David, that I think I know who may have done this. Her tip essentially sat fallow, not in any way vigorously explored for several years until a war within the FBI investigation, which I bring to light for the first time in this book, turned the focus of the investigation around.
We have some callers here. Again, our guest for this hour, David Willman. We're talking about the anthrax attacks of 2001, something that he writes about in his book, new book, The Mirage Man. We have a couple of callers. We'll start in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? I've kind of followed this story for the years that's been going on and after his death. And I think David had someone on earlier about 3 years ago, a woman from talking about this. What I think is interesting about this is that now when the spores were discovered, weren't they known to be weaponized and that they were coded individually? They weren't just like in a petri dish sort of dried up and thrown into envelopes. So weaponizing would allow them to be survive in the environment, like through a, get through a postal system and stuff like that. So I find it real interesting that there are all these discussions about this subject, yet USAMRID and those other labs are allowed to create these devices, which are actual biological weapons, and they, under the guise of experimentation, so they're not to contravene the treaties that I think Nixon signed. But I'm just wondering how somebody like him, I mean, these new things you've talked about, I knew that he had harassed these people in the sorority and all this stuff, and I feel like he's kind of a quirky guy. But how can these guys get top secret clearances and are allowed to work in these extremely dangerous environments? And also, I think Nova just did a piece about him that was probably done last year, and they talked about the FBI going to his house and finding no spores at all in his house. I guess they literally vacuumed the place. So where did he do this at? I mean, assuming he did it, I mean, I'm guessing he did it because of his access to the materials, but also the fact that the weaponization of these spores, which is what the term they used in one of the articles I read, it allows them to survive. It also allows you to inhale them deeper into your lungs.
Yeah. You've given us enough questions probably to spend the rest of the show on. I wanted to give a chance to David Willman to respond. I guess particularly, and I'm sure other people have raised the question, given what we now know about Bruce Ivins' background, should he have been hired in the first place to work in this laboratory where he was working?
Well, I would agree with you, David. Your caller raised several things that are very worthy of discussion. One of the things that just shocked me in my research for the book was getting a response from the United States Army to a Freedom of Information Act request that I had filed seeking all documentation related to mental health evaluations of Bruce Ivins, who, of course, was a Ph.D. microbiologist. And the response I got from a United States Army major in very clear, legible English was, at no time during the time when Dr. Ivins was employed by the United States Army from December 1980 through his death by suicide on July 29, 2008, did the United States Army ever seek to evaluate Dr. Ivins' mental fitness to handle anthrax. This is really an outrageous fact, and it is true that Dr. Ivins made no secret of the fact that he was undergoing routine psychiatric care, that he was on psychiatric medications. We don't want to stigmatize people for that, but when you're dealing with these kind of portable pathogens that can kill a heck of a lot of people. Some would call it a weapon of mass destruction. I'm sorry, a heck of a lot more care needs to be taken. And in fact, if you're working with chemical warfare material or nuclear material, live, you know, hot fissile material, if there's any hint of instability, the United States Army will pull that personnel out of that hot, sensitive work and get a handle on the situation and study it. And with my research found that over Dr. Ivan's 28-year career with the U.S. Army, there was no such effort made. And in fact, there was just an over-tilting of deference to his role as a respected Ph.D. scientist and to his supposed right to privacy. So this is really devastating. Dr. Ivins was given a secret-level security clearance when he came in shortly after December 1980, maintained a clearance during the entire time he was there. In addition to, you know, the routine annual statements he would make when getting booster shots for a vaccine, that he was getting certain medications. He answered a federal form in 1987 that was asking about whether he had hallucinations, paranoia, and he would put question marks next to these things. Well, question marks are just that. They deserve further inquiry, and the United States Army did none of that. One other thing I'd like to speak to, if I can, very concisely, David.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your caller repeated something that is really part of the big reason why I did this book and shows how deeply ingrained false information is in the American public, and it's because the media has amplified it repeatedly. He referred, I believe, to the spores being used in the anthrax letters as being quote-unquote weaponized and quote-unquote treated. And, of course, there were a number of media accounts that drove that home. The fact of the matter is the spores were highly purified, and they were ground down to varying sizes, which helps them to go down in the lungs, but they were never chemically treated with any artificial substance to, quote-unquote, weaponize them.
Right.
Did not happen, and the FBI's the best data generated scientifically in that regard was at the Sandia National Laboratories in by mid of 2002. This was briefed confidentially to the White House, to congressional officials on Capitol Hill, but the FBI never published that data. They tried to sort of keep it private because it was considered confidential law enforcement information. And in the meantime, those who were very, you know, just very eager to try and exploit the anthrax letter attacks as a pretext for going after Saddam Hussein were running around Washington claiming that the material was treated and that it could be linked to Saddam Hussein. It became a pretext for war. I mean, this is a very, very powerful thing.
Yeah.
So that's one other thing. Your caller is correct in saying that no spores were found at Bruce Ivins' house. Why is that? Well, Bruce Ivins had a biocontainment laboratory that he could use at Fort Detrick to work with the material. In fact, he worked with these spores all the time and showered in, showered out. There's a reason why it's not in his home. I mean, probably was never taken there.
And so the evidence suggests that anything that he did, whatever it was he did with the material to prepare it, was likely done at that U.S. Army research lab where he worked.
Yes. I mean, the fact is one of the most damning pieces of evidence against Bruce Ivins is that he spent a series of extraordinarily late-night hours in the biocontainment hot suite at Fort Detrick by himself with no plausible explanation for his activity there for a string of nights preceding the September 18th postmark letters and then another continuum of this activity before the August 9th, 2001 postmark letters. In fact, his extraordinary hours in the hot suite, which is what it's called, began in August of 2001 and then accelerated in that period between September 11th and September 18th.
And in this hour of the program, David Willman is our guest. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, and we're talking about his new book, The Mirage Man. It's about the anthrax attacks of 2001. Bantam is the publisher. Let's go back again to the phones here. We have a caller in Belgium to talk with on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Sir, I listened to your interview last Friday on WHYY in Philadelphia, and I sorely wanted to speak to you then, but I was not available at that time. And you just touched on a topic that Mr. Inge hasn't come to yet in this interview, and that's the connection between us and the wars we've dealt with, and why so many people took this opportunity to push it into a war in Iraq. Even Colin Powell took it to the UN. And this, there was a Marine officer, and Mr. Inge interviewed him back then, who kept saying, "No, this isn't true. No, this isn't true." And everybody had to take this anthrax to Iraq to make us go to war that we did not need to prosecute, and which has given us many problems since then, including our economic one to this day. Hmm. Can you speak on that, sir?
And that certainly is an aspect that you deal with in the book. Go ahead.
I do deal with it in the book. I tell you, some of these events, when you reconstruct them, are nothing short of shocking. We talked earlier about how the letter addressed to then-Senate Majority Daschle landed on October 15, 2001, on Capitol Hill. The FBI took that evidence, that letter addressed to Senator Daschle, and it was opened on the Hill, so the anthrax was already, you know, kind of billowing out of the envelope. But they boxed it up and drove it up to Fort Detrick, Maryland, for analysis, because the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia, is not equipped to handle this kind of live biological agent. Actually, protocols were in place to handle this kind of evidence. So the letter addressed to Senator Daschle was taken up there. A seasoned microbiologist named John Ezell, who had worked with the FBI over years to develop the protocol, conducted the first analysis of the material. And then within 48 hours, something very unfortunate happened. Others up at Fort Detrick on the Army staff there circumvented the FBI protocol, were in great excitement, and perhaps in their mind with good intentions, said, "We can't wait for an FBI investigation. This is a matter of national security." So they saw to it that not just a pinch of anthrax from the Daschle letter, but the entire envelope containing the anthrax was handed over to Bruce Ivins for him to analyze for their benefit. So Ivins took the letter from the repository, signed out for it, took it to his biocontainment laboratory, worked on the evidence, which anybody in law enforcement knows this is a grievous violation of chain of custody for evidence. And then almost contemporaneously, one of these same Army officials is running down to Washington in the company of a supervising general and going to the Pentagon, meeting with Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, and saying that we've looked at the powder, I've looked at it under a microscope myself, and it's weaponized with, looks like bentonite, which is a signature of the old Iraqi anthrax program. I mean, you can imagine this is a hair-on-fire moment. Paul Wolfowitz, of course, had been pushing for toppling Saddam Hussein since the Persian Gulf War in the 90s. The next stop for this scientist from Fort Detrick, colleague of Bruce Ivins, was where else? The White House. And so he briefed it to several cabinet members that same night at the White House. Then we had, of course, amplifying news accounts, the most infamous of which was October 26, 2001, ABC News investigative correspondent Brian Ross broke what seemed like a tremendous exclusive, saying that the initial tests on the anthrax material sent to Senator Daschle show a link to Saddam Hussein because of this thing called bentonite. I'm here to tell you that in reconstructing all of this in my 2.5 years of research for this book, these accounts are completely false. There was no bentonite in the material. The material was not weaponized. It was not chemically treated. But yet, that you can tell from your earlier very articulate caller that sort of conventional wisdom remains out there, and I find it amazing. Your most current caller refers to Colin Powell, who, of course, on February 5th, 2003, at the United Nations in a very dramatic moment when he was trying to encourage the international community to get behind a coalition effort to attack Iraq, displace Saddam Hussein, held up a tiny vial of white powder and said just this much powder brought Washington, D.C. to its knees, killed at least two postal workers, and Saddam Hussein has not accounted for not even a teaspoon of this powder, which is what this is, let alone the massive stocks that we think he has. So just absolutely very powerful imagery amplified by woefully inaccurate media accounts. Yeah.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. There's another a big piece of the story here that I want to make sure we talk about. For something like 5 years, the FBI's prime suspect was somebody else, was another scientist, a man named Stephen Hatfill, who they pursued very aggressively, turned the guy's life upside down, He ended up suing the government, and they settled for close to $6 million. And then they made it clear when they announced in 2008 that they believed that the person responsible was Bruce Ivins, that for once and for all, they were saying, no, Stephen Hatfield's not the guy. What about Stephen Hatfield got their attention, and what sort of evidence did they have that suggested that he might be the person responsible?
Well, Stephen Hatfield had worked at Fort Detrick from 1997 to September of 1999. Important dates, David, because after 1999, there is no verified documentation, information that Stephen Hatfield ever again had access to a biocontainment laboratory. Two things are crucial if you're going to be handling spores to load into letters. You need to have an up-to-date anthrax vaccine, and you need to have a facility that can contain the anthrax so you're not going to be killing a whole bunch of coworkers and animals and neighbors working with this stuff. Stephen Hatfield had neither, contrary, by the way, to another prominent media account that said he had up-to-date anthrax vaccinations. My research shows that is just not true. So Stephen Hatfield was a virologist. His work was in studying viruses. As we know, anthrax is a bacterium. He did not have the expertise, but yet he became the lead suspect for the better part of 5 years. Initially, I think it needs to be said that the FBI had to look very hard at Stephen Hatfield because Hatfield was a swashbuckling bragger who sent sort of indications to a lot of people that he might be up to things that, you know, were beyond what is acceptable. So several of his current or former colleagues actually called the authorities and said, you know, you ought to look really hard at this guy. I have in the book that a polygrapher, a guy who was conducting polygraph lie detector examinations for a national intelligence agency, called the FBI and said, you know, you really ought to look very closely at this guy. The other thing that initially put a focus on Hatfield was that he had several prescriptions written and or filled for the antibiotic Cipro in the year 2001, and that raised a lot of concern because Cipro became the sort of antibiotic of choice to try and treat anthrax infections. It turns out it's pretty quickly debunked the significance of that because Hatfield was battling sinus infections and, in fact, was undergoing surgery related to a deviated septum on the morning of September the 11th, 2001. So I think you have to say that Stephen Hatfield is someone that needed to be looked at very vigorously initially, but the evidence was just never there. I mean, he didn't have access to this anthrax. He didn't have the expertise to handle it. But yet we go on and on. And one of the linchpins of the FBI case against Hatfield, and it was pushed very close to Hatfield's indictment, was the work of these three bloodhounds that were brought in from Southern California. It's just spectacular, again, in reconstructing this, you know, what could people know in real time, the faith that was put in these bloodhounds. As I point out in the book, I mean, the FBI director and his handpicked inspector in charge who was leading this case briefed the case against Hatfield to Senators Daschle and Leahy on January 9th of 2003. They later briefed essentially the same information even more to then-Attorney General John Ashcroft. It took a war within the investigation, which, again, I bring to light for the first time in this book, in 2006 is when it came to a head, this war within the investigation, to eventually turn it around, and Director Mueller installed new leadership as of September, October of 2006, which reassessed all assumptions, all leads and suspects, and that led ultimately to Bruce Ivins.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left. Again, our guest in this hour is investigative journalist David Willman, and we are talking about the anthrax attacks of 2001 and the effort to find the person or persons responsible, something that he details in his new book, The Mirage Man. The subtitle is Bruce Ivins, The Anthrax Attacks and America's Rush to War. It's published by Bantam. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you would like, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, let's go back here to Bruce Ivins and ask the question, why? What would his motivation have been for doing this?
Well, I you know, obviously that was something that I had to explore very vigorously in my research, and I went to Lebanon, Ohio, which, of course, is a very small town about 40 miles northeast of Cincinnati. That's where Bruce Ivins grew up, the youngest of three sons, into a prominent local family. Bruce's father was a pharmacist trained at Princeton University and the University of Cincinnati. He was the proprietor, the senior pharmacist at Ivins Drugs, a business that was established in 1893. I was really struck by the ambiance of Lebanon to this day. I mean, really, it evokes a Norman Rockwell painting. What I found, though, was that the household that Bruce Ivins grew up in was the antithesis of the perception of Norman Rockwell. It was really a house of horrors. His mother, Bruce's mother, Mary Ivins, dominated the household, routinely beat the father, Randall Ivins, and Bruce, of course, was a witness to this and was all alone in the house after his two older brothers were gone. In talking to his classmates, his contemporaries from those years, going back to grade school, in talking to one of Randall Ivins' former counterparts as a pharmacist, and a number of other people, school teachers, others in Lebanon, Bruce was socially maladjusted from a very early age. He craved approval. He craved acceptance, but he went about seeking those things in very, very weird ways. And this continued on into the University of Cincinnati. When he asked a young woman out for a date as an undergraduate, she said no, quickly apparently forgot about it. He never did. He attributed the rejection to her membership in that sorority, Kappa Kappa Gamma. He began casing the Kappa house at the University of Cincinnati and ultimately was breaking into Kappa sorority houses to steal various artifacts, which he would then advertise in classified ads in Rolling Stone magazine, Mother Jones, and then send them to people who wrote into him. Of course, he was posting them under a false name. He had no fewer than at least 11 pseudonyms that he was doing a lot of these underhanded things as. And, you know, even wrote a letter in the name of Nancy Hagwood to a local newspaper in the 80s defending hazing, and then sending, what he did was he sent a copy of that published letter to a woman who had lost her child to a hazing incident at college, and had become prominent in trying to raise awareness about these kind of abuses. But the reason why Bruce Ivins sent that woman the copy of the counterfeit letter he had created was to try and elicit dirt on Kappa Kappa Gamma. Just, you know, a lot of twisted motivations there. The other thing with Bruce Ivins I think needs to be bear in mind is the pinnacle of his research as an army anthrax researcher was try to develop, as you alluded to earlier, David, a new anthrax vaccine, a next-generation anthrax vaccine that would be genetically engineered. He actually held two patents on that vaccine. He desperately wanted that to be brought online. He thought it was superior to the existing anthrax vaccine, which we know has a lot of controversy attached to it. It was clear to Bruce Ivins by 1999, 2000, absolutely clear in 2001 that product, his baby, was not going to make it. It was going nowhere. In the words of the supervising major general, who I quote for the first time in this book, the next generation anthrax vaccine was, quote unquote, beyond the back burner. What Bruce Ivins needed was crisis to move things. He was a student of how the media and the government interplay in this country, and I believe that a big part of his motive was to create this shock and awe atmosphere. And lo and behold, we had a whole bunch of policy ramifications from the anthrax letter attacks. We moved the Patriot Act over the goal line immediately. It was the letter attacks were used as a pretext for the Iraq War, and we then started proliferating across the country biodefense research. We had something called Project BioShield, multi-billion-dollar ongoing effort to throwing money at new medical products against potential biological warfare materials. The first contract awarded under Project BioShield for $877.5 million was for the next generation anthrax vaccine upon which Bruce Ivins held two patents. Never would have happened without the anthrax letter attack.
Yeah. So certainly it seems that one can build a convincing case based on evidence of his past life, his personality, and certainly, you know, as one says, when you're looking at crimes, he had opportunity in the sense that he had access to the anthrax, he had a place to do the work, and he had motive, both his desire for attention and the fact that he was particularly trying to get attention directed to this thing that was his life's work, which he saw slipping away. One thing that seems to have come up again and again, and maybe you have some thoughts about this, one of the big questions is regards the letters. The letters were mailed from a mailbox in Princeton, New Jersey, and there seemed to be questions raised about whether, in fact, he could have actually had the time to drive from Maryland to New Jersey and back in a reasonable kind of time frame without some people noticing that he had been gone for some extended period of time.
Well, interesting point, David. In fact, Bruce Ivins was really a master at making very long nighttime drives. He would plan them out. He would make these long drives, let's say to Morgantown, West Virginia, to break into a Kappa office there. He would drive from Frederick, Maryland to Ithaca, New York, to drop off anonymous packages for this one woman who he was obsessed with. By the way, that's like an 11-hour round trip for him to Ithaca from Frederick, Maryland. I've driven the route from Frederick to Princeton, New Jersey. It can easily be done in less than 8 hours. So if you look at Bruce Ivins' accounted for time, I think he was last checked out at one of those key nights before September 18th, 2001, at 7:15 p.m., and he's not accounted for until he shows up for work the next morning at 7 a.m. His wife, by Bruce's own acknowledgement, never knew where he was at night. I mean, he would go out and there would be no questions asked and none given, or no answers given. So making the drive from Frederick to Princeton would have been entirely within his range. The other thing, of course, is very curious about that location. There's only one mailbox in that whole greater Trenton, New Jersey area where spores were found, and the Postal Service and FBI checked well over 600 boxes. The only box where spores were found was at 10 Nassau Street, right across the street from Princeton University. If you then go to the first business door, right there about a few yards away, and go upstairs and then down back the hall to the fourth floor office that is almost perpendicular directly above the mailbox, it is an office of Kappa Kappa Gamma. Bruce Ivins had collected the information on literally hundreds of Kappa chapters throughout the eastern United States. He knew where they all were. And I must say, when I first started in on the research for the book, I was a little skeptical of the Kappa Kappa Gamma connection to this postal box location. But when you take into account the totality of his obsession with this institution and the fact that he likes to, I think, do things that have a twist to it, it definitely lines up.
We have at least one more caller here we want to get in Piatone, line number four. Hello.
Hey, good morning. I've heard these stories about this guy and some other stuff, but honestly, this whole war that we went through, I think it's just like Vietnam, personally. I think a lot of people, I don't know one person, honestly, that agrees with that, the war itself. They all say the same thing I do. It's a Vietnam political type war. And America is better than this to try and get involved in. We never went to Saudi Arabia, where a lot of these guys were from to begin with. We never went after the so-called person that we should have gone after. And I think if we'd have done that, we could have saved a lot more lives, because I'm pretty darn sure somebody knew something. Secondly, we're going to have to take a look at next time somebody decides they want to pull the trigger on going into another country. I think it's about time the rest of the world starts taking care of itself. And I know somebody's going to call in and say, well, they can't. They got to look up to America. Well, America's going down the toilet right now. How are we going to defend the rest of the world and defend ourselves? And I ask this question because, point blank, people in the government will sell out secrets of their fellow man just to make a buck. And tells me one thing, that America is greedy.
We're coming down here to the end. I appreciate the comments of the call. And I guess one of the things I want to make sure that we do, Mr. Willman, is that I give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about what we should perhaps have learned as a result of this experience. And I think you're making the strong argument that, in fact, there were lessons to be learned, but we didn't learn them.
Right. And one of these ties in, actually, I think, to the caller's concern is that there is overwhelmingly convincing evidence that the anthrax used in these letters was not chemically treated, did not have bentonite or any other additive put into it artificially that would suggest a connection to Saddam Hussein or any other state-sponsored terrorist program. But yet, that information continues to be drowned, and it helped drive us into a war. I think one of the things that makes the anthrax letter attacks, in my opinion, the most consequential crimes of our lifetime is that in direct response to the anthrax letter attacks, not only did we award the $877.5 million contract for development of Bruce Ivins's anthrax vaccine, but we're spending billions of dollars to proliferate literally hundreds of laboratories around the country that are handling materials, anthrax, tularemia, plague, Ebola, that can be used for a biological attack. Now, originally this was with a noble purpose of trying to develop medical products that could protect us, but we're bringing in thousands of new scientists, technicians to handle these materials, and as the book makes clear, and I really think this is an important policy contribution that people, I hope, give some thought to, we don't have the stringent new personnel controls that would give confidence that we're not growing the insider threat. We know that the biggest biological terrorism attack on this country was perpetrated, the evidence shows convincingly in my book, by an insider, by a United States Army civilian microbiologist who was never mentally checked by the U.S. Army. He was working at a facility where he could go into a lab 24/7 with absolutely no supervision of his work, and it's just freestyle. That kind of atmosphere has really not been addressed because there's been so much denial that these attacks were perpetrated by an insider, and the engine for the denial is coming from a lot of the people who originally had supervised Bruce Ivins and were part of this biodefense community who just don't want to come to terms with the problem that we have in our midst.
Yeah. I wish we could continue, but we can't. We're here at the end. There is more to this very rich and complicated and fascinating story in the book, and if you would like to read it, the title is The Mirage Man, about the anthrax attacks of 2001, published by Bantam, by our guest David Willman, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and has written for the L.A. Times. And Mr. Willman, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, David.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show that we first broadcast on June 23rd. This and many other programs are available for you to listen to anytime you like on our web archive. And that's will.illinois.edu. You can also go there and check up on the schedule for this program. Maybe I'll mention again that the show that we had scheduled for the first hour, conversation with Christian Parenti, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence, well, see if we can get that rescheduled for another day. We just weren't able to make contact with him. We will be live in hour number two. Celeste Quinn is hosting the 11 o'clock hour today, and she will talk with historian Gary Scott Smith. And they'll be talking about a book that he's written. The title is Heaven in the American Imagination, which looks at the fact that indeed many Americans today, in fact throughout our history, have said they believed in heaven. So the question is, well, what's it look like and how do you get there? He explores that. Those questions and a lot of other things in the book I think should be an interesting conversation, so that's coming up in the next part of Focus. Let me also take an opportunity to tell you about what we'll be doing tomorrow on the show. In the first hour, our guest is Carl Lippo. He is an archaeologist. He teaches at California State University, Long Beach, and we will talk about Easter Island, something that people, I think, are familiar with. At least when you hear that name, you think of those big statues. And it's always been something of a mystery. People wondered, well, what did those statues mean? Who made them, and what happened to those people? And it has long been offered as an example of what happens when people destroy their environment. Well, our guest, Carl Lippo, has a very different take on that, very different from what is the conventional explanation. He says, in fact, those people did a good job of managing their environment, and the problems they faced were really things that came from outside. So that's tomorrow in the 10 o'clock hour. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon with 10 different topics.
If a vaccine cost $1.98 per life saved, that might sound like a good investment.
And if it's $198 million per life saved, that sounds like not a good thing to do, but where to draw the line is the part that any sensible person will run away screaming from trying to answer that question.
Economic realities and tough decisions behind which vaccines get recommended. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Right now, we'll take our usual break so we can bring you an update on the markets. And with the numbers, here's Tom Rogers.
And thanks, David. The
wheat market is still on its way upward. The beans also up at this hour. The little profit-taking, though, going on in the corn pip. September wheat in Kansas City currently trading up a dime at 788. The September Chicago contract up 4¾ cents at 698¼. Wheat for December at 735, up 8¼ cents. Nearby September corn in Chicago, down 2½ cents right now at 695½ a bushel. December at 683, down 4¼. March down 4¼ at 695. Crude oil for August up 52 cents a barrel at 98.02. August soybeans right now are up 2 cents. The nearby contract trading at 1381¼. September, 1380½, up 3½. November also up 3½ at 1385½. January, 1394¼, up 3½. Bean meal for August is currently up 10 at 3.